Hello and welcome to the Palliative Care Journal Watch podcast by Pallium Canada for November 2024, where our panel of palliative care experts keeps you informed of the latest peer-reviewed palliative care literature. Our hosts, Dr. Jose Pereira and Dr. Sharon Watanabe, join us for the 15th episode of the Palliative Care Journal Watch. If you'd like to access accompanying slides and links to the articles discussed in today's podcast, visit the link in the episode notes. This podcast is a collaboration between Pallium Canada and the divisions of palliative care at Queen's University, McMaster University, McGill University, University of Toronto, University of Manitoba, University of Calgary, University of Alberta, and the Hadassah Hebrew University Medical Center in Israel. It is a part of the Palliative Care ECHO project, which aims to support continuous professional development among healthcare providers across Canada who care for patients with life-limiting illness. The Palliative Care ECHO project is supported by financial contributions from Health Canada. However, the views expressed in today's episode do not necessarily represent the views of Health Canada. With no further ado, it's time for the Journal Watch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our 15th session. Yes, we've done 15 already over the last 2 years or so of the Pallium Palliative Care Journal Watch. My name is Jose Pereira, and today we'll be joined by my co-host, Dr. Sharon Watanabe, as well as Dr. Aingaran Sinaraja and Dr. Leonie Hirks. Welcome to the session. The Palliative Care Journal Watch is a regular series of webinars that keeps you up to date on the latest peer-reviewed palliative care literature. We have palliative care experts from several divisions of palliative care medicine across Canada and internationally, regularly monitoring over 30 journals. And what they do is they identify and highlight articles that have the potential to challenge us to think differently about a topic or confirm our current practices. Now, the Journal Watch is part of a program of Pallium Canada, specifically the Palliative Care ECHO Project of Pallium Canada, and this is supported by a financial contribution from Health Canada. Pallium Canada's ECHO Project aims to cultivate communities of practice and provide additional palliative care-related continuing professional development opportunities for healthcare providers across Canada and internationally to complement its LEAP courses program. And we invite you to visit our website at www.echopalliative.com, where you can learn more and check out our upcoming ECHO sessions that cover a variety of palliative care related topics. Now, what to expect in the session? We will highlight and discuss the top four articles that our editorial committee have selected from the many submitted by the teams who are monitoring the journals across the country. We will also provide a list of honorable mentions at the end, and the honorable mentions are articles that we thought are noteworthy, but unfortunately, due to time constraints, could not fit them into this session as well. But we do want to share with you which those are. I'm Jose Pereira, as I said earlier, and I'm professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Navarra and the Institute of Culture and Society at the University of Navarra in Spain. I'm also a clinical professor in the Division of Palliative Care in the Department of Family Medicine at McMaster University in Canada. And I'm scientific advisor and co-founder of Pallium Canada. And with that, I'll hand you over to Dr. Sharon Watanabe to present herself.
So I'm Sharon Watanabe. I'm your co-host for the session today. And I'm a palliative care physician based at the Cross Cancer Institute in Edmonton, Alberta, and also professor in the Division of Palliative Care Medicine at the University of Alberta.
Thank you. Thanks, Sharon. And over to you, Leonie.
Thanks, everyone. Yeah, so Leonie Hirks, I'm the Section Chief and Director of Pediatric Palliative Medicine for Alberta Health Services Calgary Zone and Clinical Professor at the University of Calgary in Palliative Medicine and newly Senior Scientific Director at the Palliative Institute.
Very good. Thank you. And Aingaran, over to you.
Hi, everybody. Aingaran Sinaraja. I'm the chair in the Dr. Gillian Christakis Palliative Care Research out of Queen's University and Lake Ridge Health. And I'm also an associate professor with Queen's University. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Well, that's our panel for today. So on to the articles that we've chosen for today. And today's session's got a little bit of a quantitative study focus. We're going to be looking at a study exploring the role of the cabapentinoids for chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy And to get us started on that, I think it'll be Leonie. Then we begin looking at prognostic risk stratification using C-reactive protein albumin and associated inflammatory biomarkers. After that, we'll be looking at prognoses associated with the palliative performance scale. And then we'll end off with factors associated with early palliative care among patients with heart failure. And then we'll share with you the four honorable mentions. So with that, over to Leonie.
Great. Thank you. So gabapentinoids are very commonly used to treat chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. And we know that chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy is a very common side effect of chemotherapy, with a prevalence of 30 to 55% of those receiving chemotherapy. It has a significant impact on the quality of life and can interrupt both chemotherapy and radiation treatment for cancer, thereby impacting the effectiveness of those treatments. But there's currently no systematic review or meta-analysis looking at the safety and efficacy of the use of gabapentinoids in chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, despite them being used so commonly. So this team, led by Dr. Cheng, set about to address that gap. So for methodology for their systematic review and meta-analysis, they did a search of PubMed, Cochrane, Embase, and clinicaltrials.gov databases from their inception through to September 2022. Their search terms include chemotherapy, peripheral neuropathy, chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, and gabapentin or pregabalin. For eligibility criteria, they looked at studies evaluating either the efficacy or safety of gabapentin or pregabalin for the treatment or prevention of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, and of course limited their review to randomized control trials for adults 18 years and older with any type of cancer. They performed statistical analysis with RevMan and the Metafor package, which I don't know too much about, but having a quick look through the literature seemed very standard use for meta-analysis. And they also performed quality review of the trials using the Cochrane risk of bias tool and graphing function to represent all of those, which was very good methodology. Their primary outcomes were average pain and worst pain, quality of life, and then they used the National Cancer Institute common terminology criteria for adverse events to describe the severity of organ toxicity, which in this case is the peripheral neuropathy. So through their searches, they found 2,344 applicable publications. And then after their full text review, only 8 of them met the inclusion criteria, for a total of 631 patients that were included in the analysis. About 2/3 of these were women and 1/3 men, with an average age of 50 to 55 years. And there were a variety of cancers, which I'll point out as we go through. The chemotherapies involved in these 8 studies included oxaplatin-based, taxane-based, and doxorubicin. There were 4 studies that were found for prevention of chemotherapy-induced neuropathy, and then 4 for the treatment of chemotherapy-induced neuropathy. They broke it down by safety, prevention, and treatment. So I'll go through it in that order. They were only able to do a meta-analysis looking at the safety of gabapentinoids and the prevention of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy using pregabalin, but not gabapentin, due to the, you know, significant differences in methodology of those articles. So I'll go through that. So first, with regards to safety, they identified 4 trials that compared gabapentinoids to placebo. There is 1 using pregabalin and 3 using gabapentin. And overall, through their meta-analysis review, they found that the risk of dropping out due to adverse events and fatigue as a side effect was not statistically significant when compared to placebo, both for the pregabalin and the 3 gabapentin studies. Furthermore, they found that the gabapentinoids had a similar effect as placebo on dizziness, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and rash. When they looked at prevention of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy with their meta-analysis for the pregabalin versus placebo, there were 2 trials, both of them in colorectal cancer. One was with oxaliplatin and one with paclitaxel. And overall, they found that there was no significant improvement in either average pain, quality of life, or grade 3+ adverse events with chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy versus placebo. They did identify in those particular studies that there was a trend towards decreasing worse pain, but that that was not statistically significant. The rest of their evaluation is using descriptive outcomes because they were unable to perform a meta-analysis. So looking at prevention of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy with gabapentin versus placebo, 2 studies. One was using breast cancer and paclitaxel, and nearly all of those patients had grade 1 neuropathy, but no one got grade 3 neuropathy in the gabapentin group. And there were more grade 2 and 3 toxicities in the placebo group, interestingly. In the second study, looking at gabapentin versus placebo in head and neck cancer with carboplatin and Taxol or cisplatin, and there was significantly less pain and other symptoms at 7 weeks than placebo, for example, decreased pain from mucositis. When they went on to look at the treatment of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, again using descriptive outcomes as no meta-analysis was possible, the first study looked at gabapentin versus placebo, and it was in adults with colorectal cancer and had chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy for at least a month. Using a crossover design, there were 2 6-week phases of use of gabapentin or placebo, and then a washout, and they found no benefit over placebo in that trial. When they looked at pregabalin versus gabapentin, a study there looked at any type of cancer, includes paclitaxel, and carboplatin, and both groups received reduction in pain at 8 weeks. When they looked at pregabalin versus duloxetine, there were 2 studies that looked at taxane-induced neuropathic pain in breast cancer, and no differences were found in pain, quality of life, or neuropathy score. They did note that duloxetine showed some higher risks of insomnia, but also had improved emotional functioning. So overall, their summary of the results for treatment with chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy was that there was no consistency in the studies and no definitive benefits that they could describe over the placebos. So in their discussion, they talked really, as I've alluded to, the heterogeneity of sparse data and inconsistent findings. Overall, they concluded that gabapentinoids, both pregabalin and gabapentin, were safe in regards to prevention of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. Gabapentinoids, they concluded, did not significantly reduce the incidence or the severity of peripheral neuropathy, but that overall the evidence was too weak to warrant their use without further study. For the treatment of chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, they showed some studies have a potential therapeutic effect, but because the results are very inconsistent, there was no way to make it clear that there's definitive benefits over placebo. So overall, really called for more comprehensive and higher quality research to really help direct how to use gabapentinoids in both of these contexts. So the strengths, of course, is that it was a well-done systematic review and meta-analysis looking at both safety and effectiveness of gabapentinoids in chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, and they did include 8 randomized control trials with 631 patients, but significant limitations in that there is a small number of included studies overall from their 2,300 eligible ones, which really gave an insufficient sample size to allow for adequate subgroup analysis. And there is so many different types of cancers and different types of chemotherapy that increases the uncertainty of the results. So I think looking at it from through my lens, I think, you know, this is something we use very commonly. And really, this points out to me that we don't really have robust data and really more evidence is needed to really feel confident about their use, but certainly reassuring that there's few adverse events and the side effect profile is quite low. So is there much to be lost by trying it? I know that they did make reference that there's a new randomized double-blind control trial that's underway looking at specifically the efficacy of gabapentin in preventing paclitaxel-induced peripheral neuropathy, which, you know, those first studies seem to indicate there may be better support for. But I'm curious to see what the panel has to say about this, you know, common symptom that we see and common use of these drugs.
Thanks, Leonie. I must say, when I saw this paper, I was taken by surprise because I must be honest, I do often prescribe in these cases gabapentin or pregabalin. So this paper did take me by surprise. If anything at all, I was surprised that when I read through the introduction part of the manuscript, the authors highlight that different international associations have had different opinions about the use of these medications for chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. And I must be honest, I thought that it was a done deal that we would use them. So that took me by surprise. I found this fascinating. Angeran, Sharon, any thoughts? Will this change your practice?
Yeah, thanks, Leonie, for presenting this paper. I think having a systematic review and meta-analysis on this topic is an important contribution. I would say based on practice patterns amongst the oncologists at our cancer center, duloxetine is considered first line for pain related to chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. And that brings up another point that is important to distinguish between chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, which is a syndrome that can have multiple manifestations, versus pain related to CIPN. And so sometimes we see patients who are on pregabalin, but they don't actually have pain. They have numbness, tingling, what have you. And so we then counsel them, well, if it's not pain, we don't expect there to be benefit from these drugs that are targeted more at the pain component of the syndrome.
Sharon, you mentioned the duloxetine. I found something fascinating in the paper as well that they wrote, and I say this because I've also prescribed duloxetine, and the authors of this particular paper that we're presenting today, which, by the way, for those of you listening on the podcast, this was published in the British Medical Journal, Supportive and Palliative Care Journal, in the August issue of this year. But the authors wrote, a systematic review and meta-analysis published in 2022 revealed that the antidepressant duloxetine, which had been suggested to have some benefit in the prevention and treatment of chemo-induced peripheral neuropathy, had a limited role. And I was surprised by that as well. So I'm going to go back to that reference and take a look at it as well. Angaran, your thoughts?
I agree with what everybody has said, right? It is commonly used, I think, across the palliative care world and at least in Canada. But surprising to see that it's still not the greatest evidence. It also reminds me of a newsletter, This Changed My Practice. It's a group in British Columbia that sends out periodic updated distillation of evidence. And they had a gabapentin review recently. And they also highlighted in that, again, high doses of gabapentin is also not proven to be any more beneficial, which I sometimes push up the doses, or maybe higher doses will work. But even that doesn't have much evidence. And so we do have to be careful with all of this, isn't it? Yeah, thank you.
The next paper is entitled Prognostic Risk Stratification Using C-reactive Protein Albumin and Associated Inflammatory Biomarkers in Patients with Advanced Cancer in Palliative Care. The authors are G. Da Silva and colleagues, and this was published in 2024 in Current Problems in Cancer. So the background to this is the following. The authors highlight that accurate prediction of survival helps decision-making and care planning in cancer care, and that different prognostic tools are available in patients with cancer, but they highlight their suboptimal accuracy. And over the years, there's been discussions and proposals that we could be using inflammatory markers and indices derived from them to help with prognostication. So the inflammatory markers would be C-reactive protein or CRP and albumin serum levels. And then indices derived from them are the modified Glasgow prognostic score, which has got scores of 0, 1, 2. It combines both the albumin level and the C-reactive protein level, with various levels, and the higher the markers or the lower the albumin level, the higher the Glasgow prognostic score will be. And then the other indice is the CRP to albumin ratio, also referred to as the CAR or CAR. Now, they do mention that in the past, different prognosticating thresholds have been proposed for these markers, but they're often dichotomous. So, for example, in the case of CRP, they will often say if you've got a CRP of 10 milligrams per liter or more, that would be the threshold, or an albumin level of less than 3.5 grams per deciliter, that would be the threshold. And so what these authors have said, that perhaps that's too dichotomous, that's oversimplified, and perhaps what we should be looking at is at different thresholds for these markers. And so the study aim was to evaluate the prognostic value of CRP, albumin, CAR and the modified Glasgow prognostic score at different thresholds in patients with advanced cancer. The study design, it was a prospective cohort study that was undertaken in a palliative care unit in Brazil between July 2016 and March 2020. And the inclusion criteria were patients of the age of 20 or over and a Karnofsky performance status of 30% or higher. Exclusion criteria were the absence of laboratory data and previous diagnoses of autoimmune and infectious diseases. And so the different thresholds they set were as follows. For CRP, they said less than 5 versus 5 to 10 versus greater than 10 milligrams per liter. For albumin, the thresholds they stated was less than 2.4, and that's grams per deciliter, versus 2.4 to 2.9 versus 3 to 3.5 versus greater than 3.5. For the CAR, they set it at less than 1.2 versus 1.2 to 2 versus greater than 2 as a score. And then for the modified Glasgow prognostic score, they stated at equal to 0 versus 1 versus 2. And they evaluated the predictive accuracy of these thresholds to predict death within 90 days. So the results, 1,877 patients were included of an original cohort of 2,153, so a pretty big study. And the patient characteristics were a median age of 62, females 57%, There were different cancers. The most common were gastrointestinal cancers, gynecological cancers, and head and neck cancers. The colonoscopy performance scale, the median was 50% with an interquartile of 40 to 60. The median overall survival was 51 days with an interquartile of 19 to 124, so pretty wide. And 64% of patients died within 90 days. The median survival was 7.5 times lower in patients with albumin levels of less than 2.5 grams per deciliter as compared to over 3.5. The median survival was 4 times lower in patients who had the highest levels of CRP, CAR, and the modified Glasgow performance scale. When they looked at the survival curves, they found significant differences in 90-day overall survival across the three thresholds for CRP, for albumin, for the CAR, and for the modified Glasgow performance scale. And that was statistically significant across those different markers and indices and the different thresholds. And all markers and indices were able to predict 90-day mortality when they did a multivariate model analysis. Interestingly, the CAR was a CAR of two or more was associated with the highest risk of 90-day mortality than the other markers and showed the best predictive accuracy. So limitations of the study, a single center, and as they described, they did not exclude patients with acute infections. And so they indicate that it is possible that some patients had infections and that their biomarkers may have been increased because of the infections. And then the last limitation that they described was that they studied only cancer in general. They did not look at the cancer subtypes and suggest that there may possibly be some differences between the different subtypes. So why is this article important? In their conclusion, and I found it interesting, was inflammatory markers and their severity can be used to predict prognosis in palliative care, that it is important to look at different thresholds and not just use that dichotomous thresholds that perhaps we've used in the past, and that the CAR thresholds provide the best discriminatory power. And with that, I'll end. And curious to see what my colleagues think of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think through the various, it almost seems like there's hundreds to thousands of prognostic type tools out there and scores.
It's difficult to keep track of it, right?
Yeah, and I guess one thing that this made me think about is the blood work that's needed to work on this. And that's something we normally, albumin probably we do commonly, but CRP I almost never have ordered as a routine part of palliative care practice. And I'm curious about how and whether it's useful to start ordering. Maybe it's on specific context where there's some dilemma about prognosis and whether there's somebody's appropriate for certain places or not. So that those thoughts popped in my head as I listened.
You know, I'm thinking back about 20 years ago, if not more, Neil MacDonald, who was one of the pioneers of palliative care in Canada and internationally, and a guru around cancer cachexia, would often say, you know, we should be looking at CRP. It is important and we should explore it further. So I can hear Neil's words echoing through the session. And a colleague of ours, Martin Chasen, in a palliative care rehabilitation clinic in Ottawa, Canada, was doing the CRPs and found that it predicted whether someone could complete a palliative rehabilitation clinic program or not.
Hi, thanks for presenting this. Just one other comment. So I note that the population in which this study was conducted were patients who were no longer on cancer treatment.
Correct.
And so I was, you know, reflecting on would that change my practice? And so, you know, if I'm seeing someone who I know can no longer receive cancer treatment, we'll cover, you know, end of life planning and so forth. So whether that having that additional information would change the conversation, I'm not sure, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Angaran, I think your turn's up to present.
Thanks. And a similar theme, isn't it, around prognostication? And this is looking at the traditional palliative performance scale that was, you know, developed right here in Canada. So it is used as a prognostic tool amongst other reasons. And so this is a study that is looking to update the actual prognosis and survival based on those PPSs. And so this was a study published in JAMA Network Open in July of this year. The traditional, again, scores and expected survivals, the literature is starting to get a little bit old and they have not been updated recently. And so that's why they did this. So this study was looking at the University of California, San Francisco population. They have an electronic health record, and they linked it with the vital stats to look at those who have died. And these were patients who had received palliative care consultation, so you have to keep that in mind. This is not the general population. These are people who have been seeing the palliative care teams. And then they looked at how the PPS scores were associated with 1 month, 6 month, and 12-month survival, and looked at cancer versus non-cancer, as well as outpatient versus inpatient, and then mode around in-person versus video. And they did various analysis based on this. So in total, there was almost 5,000 patients with sort of roughly equal split between inpatient and outpatient. And by 30 months of follow-up, about 61% of the inpatients and 43% of the outpatients had died. So some of the key findings, and a lot of this will not be surprising, I think, to a lot of us in the day-to-day practice. In the first month after PPS, the mortality was highest. If somebody survived to 12 months, regardless of what PPS they started off with, eventually the curves plateaued out and they were all, subsequent mortality was actually low and similar across all the PPSs. And remember, we are looking at just the PPS, the first ever PPS, first contact. So they don't look at how PPSs changes over time. The other thing that they found is that the prognosis associated with each PPS scores were now substantially longer than previous estimates that were commonly being used in the previous literature. If it was an inpatient setting, it did seem to have a good ability to discriminate between those who lived and those who died. But once you got into the outpatient setting and seeing people in the outpatient setting, PPS, the survivals were longer and there was less discrimination between the various PPSs. Patients with cancer, the mortality was higher in terms of the PPS compared to non-cancer. And then they also found that in-person versus video consultations, there was no difference in PPS mortality. So they both performed equally, meaning the clinician is probably good at estimating PPS even over video consultation or visit. So in discussing this, you know, again, we have to be mindful. PPS should not be probably the only tool we use in prognostication. We also have to think about the reason for using PPS. Is it just for prognostication, or as we just heard, to prompt an appropriate conversation with the patients and families about their needs? Short-term estimation seems to be okay, especially on the inpatient side. Outpatient, it didn't work as well. Video conferences could be used for PPS calculations. And then I'll point you to also this e-prognosis calculator that their team actually has on the website, on the public website. And they have now updated the survival that it spits out based on this new work. And then we mentioned this PPS trajectory and what happens as PPSs changes over time, and maybe prognosis actually needs to be updated as PPSs change. So interesting to think about why these prognoses have improved. That's something I thought about. You know, is there better disease treatments, earlier palliative care? We know sometimes that improves survival, and maybe that's why things have changed. What about subtypes of cancer, types of non-cancer? You know, what might PPS do around that? How does this US study compare to Canada? Do we need to think about even provincial, local jurisdictions and how PPSs are predicting things? Certainly a large cohort, and that's a strength. We're seeing some updated prognosis, which I think speaks to the reality of what we all seen. And then the limitations, again, are this is not as racially diverse in this population. There was not enough multiple PPS measurements, which is why they didn't actually present on that in this paper. Only 30 months of follow-up. And remember, these patients only saw palliative care. And so what is it if it's people who have not seen palliative care yet? So I'll stop there and invite the panel to weigh in.
Thanks, Angaran. And again, this was published in the JAMA Network Open in the July issue of this year. And the first author is Bischoff, K.E. This is also, again, I think another fascinating paper. I'm intrigued, as you say, by the variations according to setting. And in terms of the prognosis being longer than they expected, I wonder whether, because they did it, as they say, only once, perhaps we're seeing more of these illness trajectories where there are these crises and temporarily the functional status declines. You do an intervention, function improves, maybe not to what it was originally, but it improves. And perhaps because of the setting where these patients are coming in, perhaps they're being seen at a time where they're having one of these crises and their functional status has declined temporarily. So I'm wondering whether that's a factor. Curious to hear what the others think.
Yeah, especially it was clear in the hospital setting that it was better able to predict the short-term prognosis, right? So if they're coming in with a health crisis and some sort of thing that's requiring them to have acute care, that makes sense that their mortality risk would go up. Yeah, really, it would be helpful to really get an understanding of the trajectory, which you've already well pointed out, Eingren. And if there's any difference in age group stratification, I'd be very curious about that, older versus younger, which I would expect there to be. No, Sharon, what are you thinking? I see you nodding.
Sharon, one of your papers, one of your studies was referenced, your Journal of Pain and Symptom Management study of 2011 with Yoko Terumi, where you published on the association of the PAT performance scale and hazard of death in an ambulatory cancer population.
Well, I'd forgotten about that paper.
Years have gone by.
I found this really interesting, and I agree with all the reasons given for why survival may have changed, may have lengthened. And I was just looking at the graph and reassured to see, I was thinking, like, our hospices, for example, usually have a cutoff of a PPS 40% for admission. And I see that, that group still has survival probability that, some of them do survive longer than our usual 4-month time frame for hospice admission. But still, the majority are still within that cutoff.
When I read the paper, I thought it'd be really nice to go to Michael Downing and his team in Victoria, who came with a PPS over 2 decades ago. I find it's been extremely useful in clinical practice. But if I recall, it was first designed to simply be a snapshot of your functional status and to help in determining resources. And across Canada, often the PPS is, as you mentioned, is used to identify resources, to allocate resources. And if I remember correctly, it was after the fact that it started being used as a prognostic tool. So it wasn't originally developed to be a prognosticating tool. Am I recalling that correctly? Do any of you know?
That's my understanding too. And certainly that's how I've always used it and taught it to be used, is more around like functional needs and resource planning and care planning as opposed to prognostication.
Good. So let's go then to the last paper or article. So the last one was published in the Journal of Palliative Medicine. It's entitled Factors Associated with Early Palliative Care Among Patients with Heart Failure. And the first author is Meehan CP. And this is a study out of the United States, specifically out of the US Veterans Hospital System. The background that the authors highlight is that heart failure is prevalent. It's a highly prevalent life-limiting condition and associated with high burden of symptoms and needs. And increasingly, there are calls to ensure that we integrate palliative care in the care of patients with heart failure, and that there is evidence to show the benefits of integrating palliative care and palliative care early amongst these patients for patients, for families, and also the healthcare system. They highlight that patients are often not referred for palliative care, and when they are, usually late in the illness. Now, a little note here, when they refer to palliative care, I'm sometimes a bit confused in the paper whether they're referring to palliative care as a care approach or whether they're referring to a specialist service. And I think it's usually the latter. But the study objective was to explore patient factors associated with receiving palliative care in patients with heart failure. And so they undertook a retrospective cohort study using secondary analysis of data that they already had within the US Veterans Hospital System, and specifically patients with prior hospitalizations to the Veterans Affairs or VA hospitals. And these were patients who died from the beginning of 2011 to the very end of 2020. And they categorized the patients according to having received palliative care or not received palliative care. And then also for those who received palliative care, they categorized them into received it late. And by late, they meant palliative care. And again, it seems like it's a referral to the palliative care service, if I understand it correctly, but a referral to palliative care service less than 90 days before death. And for those categorized as early palliative care, these were patients who received palliative care 90 days or more before death. And they identified patients as having received palliative care by what they call stop codes. So these are codes that are used in the hospital system, in the database, And I think if I remember correctly, that these codes are used to look at clinician workload and resource utilization. So I suspect it could be a code related to team rather than a diagnosis, but I may be wrong. Now, the interesting thing is that they mentioned that palliative care services are available across all the VA hospitals in the States to varying degrees in terms of the composition of these teams and the number of clinicians. But generally, there is palliative care services across all these hospitals. So in terms of the results, massive study, over 230,000 veterans were involved, or information of veterans were included in the study. The mean age was 76.5 years, plus minus 10.7 years. Males predominant. So 98% of the folks included in the study were male. And I suspect that has to do because it's veteran affairs. So it's previous soldiers going back before a time where women have always been soldiers and were soldiers. But in this study, there's a predominance of males. There were comorbidities, dementia in 38% of the study participants, cardiac dysrhythmia 67%, valvular disease, chronic lung diseases in about half of the participants, renal disease as well in about half of them, depression in about a third, and malignancy in about a quarter. No palliative care before death, 56.5%. So in other words, just over half, 56.5% of participants in the study did not receive palliative care before death. And they highlight this as a key finding. In terms of palliative care late, in other words, less than 90 days before death, 22.5% of patients received palliative care in that way. And then 21% of patients received palliative care more than 90 days before death. In other words, 21% received early palliative care. And the veterans who died without palliative care tended to be younger with fewer comorbidities. And so in the discussion, the authors highlight the following and also conclude that many heart failure patients never receive palliative care. And for many who do receive it, it's very late. Palliative care involvement seemed to be driven by comorbidities rather than the heart failure. And they highlight the importance of effective collaboration with cardiology is needed to identify patients who would benefit from earlier palliative care involvement. So the model that I think they seem to be discussing is a model where patients be seen by a specialist palliative care team. And I wonder if anyone on the panel have any thoughts about that and about the other results in the study.
Just a couple of things that reading the paper, that it took me a while to understand the population. So these are patients who have a diagnosis of heart failure. It doesn't necessarily mean it was a significant problem. It doesn't mean that they died from heart failure. So this could have been a patient who had a cancer and then a comorbidity of heart failure. And so that one, I was thinking that knowing that 50% was really good, I thought, palliative care getting involved, knowing it's like this really huge population. So therefore, you know, I had to think about collaborating with cardiology. But if heart failure is not the most prevalent and relevant disease, like that doesn't seem. So it'll be good eventually to do a future study to look at serious heart failure and staging the heart failure and then figuring out whether palliative care.
Where the heart failure would be the primary diagnosis.
Yeah, or the different stages. Yep. And
Yeah, and I think if this is referring to specialist consultation, you know, obviously we can reach more people if we have. So how do we upskill the cardiologists themselves to be able to identify people within their own practices who have high risk of death and symptoms from their illness that would benefit from a palliative approach? And so I think giving them tools to identify who would be the right people and equipping them with skills to provide them, then knowing when to consult specialist palliative care. That's obviously an important discussion we often come back to on Journal Watch, and specialists can't certainly do the provision of all palliative care. So any thoughts on that from anyone else on the panel?
I dream of the day when the access will be 100%, whether you've got heart failure as your primary disease or you've got another disease and you happen to have heart failure as well. But I dream of the day where everyone's got the core competencies to be able to activate a palliative care approach. And I think the more we can promote that, the more we can do that, the higher the access, and there's more than enough work for everyone to help these patients.
Another interesting thing I read, which was just mentioned briefly in a sentence, is that they excluded hospitals where there was less than 20 palliative care encounters in the last 10 years. And that was interesting. Like, again, Veteran Affairs, there's lots of palliative care, like they said, but why are there still some hospitals that have very little palliative care? And they don't mention how many of those there are, and but they just said they excluded them. And so I was curious to think through an institution like that.
Actually, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the other thing they did say as well, that this, they didn't look at the quality of the palliative care received. And they acknowledged the possibility of palliative care having been received by these patients by other care providers, not within the VA system. So the numbers could be higher.
Hi, sorry, just want to back up a bit, because Dr. David Henderson had put in a couple of questions related to the previous paper in terms of PPS, in that the rate of change in the PPS is more helpful for prognostication than a single PPS in time. And then there was another question, the question about early versus late referral, whether the cutoff of 90 days is universally accepted.
I don't think the 90 days is universally accepted. I can't think of any study that somehow decided 90 days as being a magical number. I'm just wondering whether in the effort to move it earlier, because it's always been so much in the last days and weeks and last few months of life that folks have put it at 90 days. I know there've been other studies, for example, I think Kieran Quinn, but looking at a lot of patients in Ontario, also said that at 90 days, I don't know, what do you think, Sharon or Leonie Ingram? I think 90 days to help us do the studies, but it's not a magical number.
Yes. And I see Leonie wants to answer that.
No, I don't know how to answer that, actually. But I had the exact same question that Dave did when I read this article. And I was just thinking, actually, it's a number that makes sense to me, right? Like, there's so many hospitalizations and emergency room visits and things that happen in the last 90 days of life that we're trying to move palliative care upstream. So it's not an unreasonable figure, but I don't know of any evidence base that it comes out of. I don't know, Ingram, do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it as a pragmatic research approach to thinking about it. And I think that's also why teams are rephrasing it as timely palliative care and not necessarily like a 1 month, 3 month, 9 month. Because I have seen various numbers. I think ASCO goes the other way, right? From start of the diagnosis and within 8 weeks, so on. And so depending on the cancer, it can be more than 90 days. Some can be like 3 years, 4 years. And so it's sort of forward looking. And so I think there's lots of arguments, touches on sustainability of palliative care, resources, but liver disease tends to have low, late, even now. So for them, I would say, you know, 1 month or more is still early. Because right now it's only days before, right? And so I wonder over time whether we will just keep moving the post further upstream.
Well, I hope that the post is really further upstream, right? Not just the 90 days. But as you say, 90 days seems to be a pragmatic research number. But I'm sure in the future we're going to be seeing also different thresholds, as it were. Sharon, were there any others?
So Dave also made the comment that there are some business studies that speak about cost effectiveness with 4 months of palliative care interaction.
Yeah, very good. Okay, so now the honorable mentions. So we've identified four of them. The first one, also around the theme of the gabapentinoids, is a paper by Painter and colleagues published in the Journal of Pain and Palliative Care Pharmacotherapy. It's entitled The Effect of Concurrent Use of Opioids and Gabapentin on Fall Risk in Older Adults. And we thought we'd highlight this because of the impact that falls have on patients. I was just speaking to someone yesterday who works in long-term care a lot, who says, you know, one of the main reasons why folks from long-term care residencies end up in the hospital is because of falls and fractures. The next one is entitled Oral Cannabis Extract for Secondary Prevention of Chemotherapy-Induced Nausea and Vomiting, Final Results of a Randomized Placebo-Controlled Phase 2 and 3 Trial, published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, and first authors, Grimason P. The next one relates to pediatrics. It's entitled Household Material Hardship and Distress Among Parents of Children with Advanced Cancer, and it's a report from the PediQuest Response Trial, and that was published in Cancer in 2024. And the first author, and I hope I do justice to their names, is Eche Ugwu and colleagues. And the last paper that we'd like to mention in our honorable list is Virtual Reality for Pain Management in Hospitalized Patients with Cancer, a Randomized Controlled Trial. And that was done by Groninger and colleagues and published in Cancer also in 2024. Before we wrap up, I want to thank my colleagues for joining us, for working on this, for identifying the articles. Sharon, Leonie, Ingeron. Also want to thank all our colleagues in the divisions of palliative care and palliative medicine across the country who participate in this for their hard work. And they are listed here. Their hard work monitoring the journals and submitting them every few months, allowing us to go through and select as a panel of four our top ones. And to Diana and the team at Palliative Canada for all your support. Thank you very much. And with that, goodbye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. I'm James O'Hearn, and I hope you found it both enjoyable and informative. If you'd like to learn more about the Journal Watch program or our other Palliative Care Echo Project activities, please feel free to email us at echo@pallium.ca. That's echo@pallium.ca. Or visit our website at www.echopalliative.com. The music for this episode is Dazed by Airtone. Copyright 2012, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 license. You can find Airtone's music at dig.ccmixter.org. Today's episode was produced by Diana Vince. See you soon!